to generate a stable, soluble glucagon. Glucagon was well known as an antidote for insulin-induced life-threatening hypoglycemia. But it was a rather niche boutique product, if you will, and had not received any chemical optimization. If you are an insulin-taking subject, you would have known it at that point in time as coming to you as a little chemistry kit where you received a lyophilized powder of glucagon. You received a diluent, which was dilute hydrochloric acid, a syringe, and you were expected to solubilize the powder, fill the syringe, give yourself an injection while you were unconscious from hypoglycemia.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, a monthly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and all that's working in the world of metabolic health and obesity care. Our aspiration is to be the first place you are going to go to find out what's happening, the latest updates, and the latest research in GLP-1 science and clinical practice.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the GLP-1 podcast show hosted by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Arisha Moyes, and I'm really excited about today's episode. So over the past few years, GLP-1-based therapies have completely changed the conversation around obesity and metabolic disease. But I think what many people don't appreciate is that these therapies are the result of decades of work spanning chemistry, endocrinology, pharmacology, and biotechnology. So today, I'm very happy to be joined here by Dr. Richard DeMarchi, Distinguished Professor of Chemical Biology and Gill Chair in Biomolecular Sciences at Indiana University, as well as a former chair, group vice president at Eli Lilly and Company. His work has really helped shape many of the foundational ideas behind modern incretin therapeutics and multi-agonist drug development. So Dr. DeMarchi, thank you so much for joining us today. Before we dive into the science, would you mind just talking a little bit about your background? From my understanding, you left a high-level executive role at Eli Lilly to return to academia, sort of launch multiple startups. So how have these different environments shaped your perspective in drug discovery and innovation?
Yeah, it's been it's coming on a 50-year journey from my academic training, as most do, in the biological and physical sciences, that took me to the Rockefeller Institute, where I was with Bruce Merrifield, the legendary synthetic chemist that developed solid phase methods in peptide synthesis, to join Lilly at a time when biotechnology was just emerging. There were few places where you could have learned this technology, and I viewed it as a second fellowship to learn how to make these macromolecules in microorganisms. And that fellowship ended up being 22 years before I took the faculty position in Bloomington and continue to work on these glucagon-like peptides, insulins, a number of endocrine hormones. And in the midst of that, have started 8 companies in 23 years, many of them associated with metabolic diseases and obesity. It's been a phenomenal career, and it continues.
Well, that's incredible.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access Wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Some have called your approach to science almost unorthodox. Can you comment on that? And would you say this startup environment kind of helped accelerate those scientific breakthroughs more than a traditional big pharma setting could at the time?
Oh, my. Yeah, I think my career path is somewhat different than most. Certainly, it was atypical for someone at 50 years of age to leave academics to leave a pharmaceutical company where I had been a group vice president with responsibilities for global biotechnology product development to take a a faculty level position at what is an R1 research intensive institution, but a large undergraduate population. And from that begin these translational companies that have helped advance what we have learned in animals into humans. That learning that I gained in those first 20 years in being associated with pharmaceutics from discovery through manufacturing certainly has influenced and characterized how we have viewed discovery research and what might be relevant for translation.
Nice. It's definitely a unique journey. So now let's get into the GLP-1 side of things a little bit. So I think one thing that people may not appreciate is that native GLP-1 itself was never really a practical drug because of how it's broken down so quickly, right? So can you explain how advances in peptide chemistry and drug engineering helped kind of turn that incretin biology into effective therapies that we're now benefiting from?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's not just a practical therapeutic. It was not a therapeutic. It was not a drug, right? Because of the very reasons that you noted, very quickly cleared, very quickly degraded. And my approach to this began before we had mastery of the chemistry for making these macromolecules. And I had always viewed that if we could gain control of the chemistry of making peptides of this size and proteins, that we would be able to optimize them for pharmacology. Nature selects for physiology. And while it is related, overlapping with pharmacology, it is distinctly different. Right. And so once we had that capabilities, the chemical technologies that Bruce Merrifield, his laboratory, were at the forefront of advancing, and these first emergence of biotechnology, insulin clearly being that first biomedicine, that we could then begin to explore how we could optimize the molecule to do things that quite frankly, that have made these macromolecules the miraculous substances that they've proven to be.
How important would you say were half-life extension strategies, and what enabled really these once weekly therapies that we now have?
Well, it's not just the PK part of this, which began with actually making them faster. Humalog, the molecule that I had designed on the heels of the insulin registration, was to make the insulin faster, more suitable for prandial administration. And on the heels of that came the approaches to making molecules that had extended duration of actions, largely starting with polyethylene glycol polymers, PEG polymers, and then FC fusions, fatty acylations, lipidation, I have called it at times, have given us a variety of approaches for extending the duration of action. That can make them more convenient, that can make them more effective, and they've certainly played a role in taking these very short-acting incretin peptides from what have been multiple administrations a day, once a day, as Victoza was, once a week, as Trulicity, dulaglutide, first was, to now the semaglutides, the tirzepatides, the retatrutides, and a family of others, where we're now beginning to look at, can we make them once a month? Can we make them even less frequent than that? That certainly has a convenience element to it, but it also can have an efficacy performance advantage as well.
Yeah, it's nice to look back and kind of see how innovation has really shaped these therapies that we have today. And I think sometimes we forget to appreciate the chemistry side of things when we're focused so much on the biology. So it's nice to hear about that. So you kind of alluded to this a little bit. So the earlier generation of therapies have largely focused on GLP-1 receptor agonisms. But over the past several years, we've seen the fields evolve towards dual and triple agonism, targeting pathways like GIP and glucagon in addition to GLP-1. And you and others really helped pioneer this idea of multi-agonism in obesity. So what was the original rationale behind combining these pathways?
Well, I think some of it was a vision that a disease as complex as obesity, for that matter, type 2 diabetes, much like hypertension, would require more than a single mechanism of action. Particularly given the prevalence of the disease, the heterogeneity in the human population, that one single mechanism would not prove to be effective, and that certain patients would respond better to one versus a different mechanism. You know, in comparison, you could just look at how we have advanced from the decade of the 50s in treatment of hypertension, from vasodilators and diuretics to beta blockers, to the calcium channel antagonists, to the ACE inhibitors, to the A2 blockers. And in many instances, patients are on 2, 3, maybe even 4 different mechanistic approaches to treating their hypertension. So there was always this vision that this would probably require more than a single mechanism of action. Then there was the observational science part of this, that as we began to incorporate these additional mechanisms of action, we were achieving superior pharmacology. Who's the we? Well, it was largely Matthias Chupp, as he returned from Germany to take a faculty position at the University of Cincinnati, which was just 2 hours removed from where I am in Bloomington, Indiana. And we had had a history of interaction when he was a postdoctoral fellow at Eli Lilly Research Laboratory. So we began collaborations, and it began in a rather some would say, pedestrian target, because I had been about GLP. I introduced the subject to Lilly, and that work eventually led to dulaglutide, Trulicity, and they then went on to a host of multi-agonists after I had left. But those first collaborative work with Matthias is what laid the groundwork for the use of glucagon, later GIP, and then the integration into triple agonists. So I see Matthias as a full partner in what we have achieved.
That's nice. I like the parallels you drew to antihypertensive and these other drugs. Would you say there were any chemical challenges of balancing the potency of 2 or 3 different hormones into a single peptide?
The observation that was made, if I could back up just a minute, to generate a stable, soluble glucagon. Glucagon was well known as an antidote for insulin-induced life-threatening hypoglycemia. But it was a rather niche boutique product, if you will, and had not received any chemical optimization. If you are an insulin-taking subject, you would have known it at that point in time as coming to you as a little chemistry kit where you received a lyophilized powder of glucagon. You received a diluent, which was dilute hydrochloric acid, a syringe, and you were expected to solubilize the powder, fill the syringe, give yourself an injection while you were unconscious from hypoglycemia, life-threatening hypoglycemia. It made no sense. And so the whole vision was, could you make the equivalent of an epinephrine pen, something that was there ready to be used at the time of need? And that required us to slightly change the chemistry of that molecule so that it had the biophysical properties that would allow it to be soluble, stable in a physiological a diluent. We achieved that. And in so doing, we began to do experiments with that in Cincinnati and realized that it was quite effective in lowering body weight. And that doses that we were using, it was very competitive with what was the active ingredient in Byetta, Ascendin 4, the molecule that was discovered by John Ng in New York at the Bronx VA. And we quickly realized that these are two different mechanisms, right? GLP was largely working as an appetite suppressant, and glucagon was working by creating energy inefficiency. And that expenditure of energy was leading to a loss in body weight. And they were naturally married to be put together because one was buffering against the risk of hyperglycemia, and you were then achieving both of the mechanisms of action. The challenge was, how do you do that, right? How do you make a master key that's able to open two doors that with the efficiency with which a single key was able to do. And we worked out that chemistry and reported it in Nature Chemical Biology in 2009. And it was quite controversial, not so much the chemistry, the biology, because we had been working in the pharmaceutical sector and academic sectors to antagonize glucagon to lower blood glucose, and had failed for two decades, small molecules, peptide antagonist antibodies, and often because of stabilization of hepatic steatosis, right? High fat in the liver. And here what we were finding is that you could use glucagon not only to lower body weight, but to delipidate the liver, an incredibly important phenomenon, and not have the risk of hyperglycemia if you had achieved the right ratio between the two peptides, glucagon and glucagon-like peptide. And that is something that, again, dates us to 2009, and a number of companies have pursued that. Probably the most advanced so-called co-agonist is survodutide that Boehringer Ingelheim is in late-stage registration studies.
You sort of beat me to the punch a little bit, because I was going to ask you, from my understanding, glucagon has historically been viewed as counterproductive for diabetes management, right? You mentioned the hypoglycemia aspect of it. Was there any skepticism within the industry to include glucagon agonism within the weight loss molecules?
Huge. I mean, I had one very respected academic said he didn't know whether this paper deserved to be in Nature Chemical Biology, a Nature journal, or Ripley's Believe It or Not, right? It really required I guess what Toffler in Future Shock had labeled as those who are illiterate will be those who not just can't learn, but those who cannot unlearn what we believed was prophecy, right? And in fact, this was taking us in a completely opposite direction of what textbooks had taught us. But it comes back to the point that you were raising, that we had largely looked at these in isolation. One substance, what is it doing? And it was this symphony of endocrine hormones that operate physiologically to give us the balance in body weight, in glucose management, in lipid management. And what we were really recreating in a single molecule was this concert of action that was providing superior pharmacology.
That's very, very interesting. I think it really highlights the importance for advocating for your work and kind of sort of steering away from the status quo, if you will. More recently, your work has explored whether GLP-1 itself may not always be essential within these combinations. So you have newer peptide-based approaches involving pathways like PPAR signaling. So can you talk about this a little bit?
Well, that jumps ahead. Gosh, it's nearly 20 years, right? 2009 to what we just published a couple of weeks ago. But before you go there, on the heels of that work with glucagon, we were working with GIP. GIP proved to be as controversial as glucagon, while one would not have expected that, because there had been the belief that either it did not work in disease states, right, in type 2 diabetics, while it was accepted to be an active physiological incretin, or that it in fact needed to be antagonized as opposed to agonism, which remains a controversy. But we had come to realize that when used in concert with GLP-1, that you were achieving an additive effect, and at times a synergistic effect, because the beginning was no efficacy from GIP that just grew in time as GLP set this improved metabolic milieu that allows GIP to do what it does. And that was published in 2013 and really laid the groundwork for what now has emerged as these GIP-GLP co-agonists to tirzepatide developed by Lilly, right? Mounjaro and Zepbound being so important. And then 2 years later in 2015, it was the triple agonist, the ability to integrate all three into a single balanced, fully potent triagonist, what Lilly has come to call triple G, that is the basis of retatrutide. And so it takes us, 35 years to get from the discovery of the gene, Graham Bell's discovery, to the Lancet report from Novo on semaglutide lowering body weight by 15% in non-diabetic obese subjects. And here we are, less than a decade, eight years, and we're looking at body weight lowerings that are approaching twice what we had with semaglutide. So multi-agonism certainly is valuable.
Well, thank you for bringing up GIP. I've spoken to Dr. Michael Nock and Yen Yeo's your host in the past, and they mentioned GIP, how when it was discovered, it was almost not treated as monumental as GLP because it wasn't as effective. And now sort of we've repurposed it within these multi-agonism. So I think it really highlights the point that you made of not looking at these hormones in isolation and looking at them more broadly. I would love for you to comment on like the PPAR signal and also just how you see the field evolving in general from where we are now.
That transition from this multi-agonism at the cell surface level was to ask what else could we possibly integrate in with these peptide-based agonists. And I think it was in 2012, we published on a report of using these peptides to target a hormone like estrogen. And estrogen is one of these magical substances as much as insulin is a magical substance and has always held tremendous fascination for me. In fact, even before we had these wonderful cardiovascular outcomes proven with GLP-1 agonists, there was this observation and belief that estrogen itself was a cardiovascular health substance, right? That in menopause, this knockout experiment in humans in midlife that presented increased cardiovascular risk, and that the treatment with estrogen would minimize that risk. But it was always this question of how does it do it biochemically, right? And we have had that same question for GLPs. How do we in fact get the magic that we have been recording in these long-term outcome studies? And so I was just fascinated with this question of is it redundant or is it overlapping? If it really is completely redundant, then we're not going to see much more than we get from any individual agent. But if they really are unique or just minimally overlapping, then it might be a route to get much superior cardiovascular outcomes. And so we use these peptides to target estrogen to keep it away from those gynecologically sensitive tissues, the breasts, the uterus. And what we found is spectacular improvement in efficacy without the hallmark carcinogenic risk, uterine hypertrophy, breast enlargement that you would get with unopposed estrogen therapy. On the heels of that, we then turn to other nuclear hormones, of which PPARs are one, but there's also thyroid hormone glucocorticoids, where these are incredibly effective drugs in humans, but they've proven to be very difficult to use in a chronic setting, right? Acutely, they're quite effective, but they have adverse features when used chronically. And what we've shown is that we can use different peptides to target them to different locations to get this supplemental efficacy. Now something truly differentiated from the supplemental efficacy we were getting when we were mixing hormones that are acting at the cell surface. And Timo Mueller, working at the Helmholtz, was the champion for this work with lanifibranor, that is a pan-PPAR, still in registration phase, and demonstrated that at a much smaller dose, he was able to achieve a supplemental transformative efficacy in lowering body weight, improving glycemic efficacy. So this is something that we're committed to seeing through into that next phase of development, because until you see it in humans, it's difficult to know whether this is going to be something that will eventually constitute a medicine. But we're very excited by it.
Okay, perfect. Well, shifting gears a little bit, do you think we're approaching a biological ceiling for pharmacologic weight loss, or is there still room for improvement? And also, do you think that the next major advances will come from achieving greater efficacy, or instead focusing on improving tolerability and personalization?
All of the above, right? I mean, again, if you think about hypertension relative to obesity being even bigger in number and complexity and even demand for safety, right? Given what people perceive as the more benign nature of someone who has excess body weight but not a co-associated disease, I think we're just going to see an explosion of different approaches for treating the disease. You know, let's celebrate what has been done. I personally don't believe that the GLP-1 is to obesity what insulin is to diabetes. I think it has been more the first runner in showing the way and providing benefit, but also demonstrating that there are limitations. We know that the GI intolerance is notable, and that we've developed these regimented approaches to trying to achieve appropriately elevated therapeutic levels that some patients, in fact, many patients, can't tolerate. And so you can't have cardiovascular benefit if you can't tolerate the drug. So how do we deal with that? Can we find other approaches that minimize that intolerance or eliminate it? As I said, just in the case of hypertension, different approaches to achieve the same objective in lowering blood pressure. Now we have the primary issue of, can we lower body weight by a divergence of mechanisms, sometime that can be used in combination, but others as singular approaches. So it's an incredibly exciting time, right? We have different approaches to administering the drug, oral approaches, monthly injectable approaches. We have been at the forefront of developing prodrug chemistries to improve the therapeutic index of not just incretins, but other endocrine hormones like PTH and insulin, which also have narrow therapeutic index. So I'm just incredibly bullish and couldn't be more proud of how this whole field of macromolecular medicinal chemistry has unfolded to give us these miraculous substances.
I really like how you mentioned that GLP-1 might not be as married to obesity as one would assume. I think it's because when we see these incredible weight loss effects, it's easy to kind of assume that these other benefits are downstream of that weight loss. But as we know, GLP-1 receptors are found all over the body, and they have all sorts of effects, even direct effects that are independent of the weight loss when it comes to these cardiovascular benefits, these renal benefits, these benefits on inflammation. So I think that's nice. And that's really something that's worth celebrating and exploring further. It doesn't end here. There's a lot of work to be done. And I agree that it's a very exciting time.
Well, the interesting part of all of this over the course of the 50 years, as challenging as the science is, has been the non-science, right? Those business issues, the societal issues that challenge our ability to advance the science. You know, when we began to work with human insulin, there were geographies that found it unsafe mm-hmm. to produce proteins in microorganisms, particularly in bacteria. And I think Indiana was one of those that was more progressive than most in the ability not just to use the technology, but to scale it commercially, right? Lilly provided a great service to the scientific community by validating that this wasn't just biotechnology, this was biomedicine, right? Humulin was the first to demonstrate that you can make safe, effective medications. On the heels of that, there was huge skepticism that anything we would do to adjust the sequence from that which was found in nature, right, divine inspired, was something that was dangerous. At minimum, it would prove to be immunogenic. And you just go right down the list to obesity is not a disease, right? When those first observations were being made in the mid-90s that we could lower body weight, suppress appetite, we were 20 years before the American Medical Association declared it to be a disease, right? And so here we continue with questions about whether folks should even be using these drugs, and how much further we can go in improving the public health, right? In extending healthy lifespan and maybe even extending longevity. So it's an incredibly exciting time.
Thank you for bringing up the societal implications. I think right now also it's a time where there's a lot of opinions being circulated and a lot of people have a lot to say about this. To just end it off, what do you think the broader medical field or the public still misunderstands about obesity biology?
Oh, it's a lot. I mean, there's still a stigma associated with having excess body weight. There are psychological ramifications. There are economic ramifications. And I remember Carl Gerace, the father of the pill, right, had shared with me that there are certain times when pharmacology exceeds its intended purpose, right? And certainly contraception was one of this, and the impact that it had in controlling fertility and the whole women's liberation movement. I think we may be achieving that same thing in the ability to control body weight. I don't have people so much coming up to me and telling me, I'm just so pleased with my ability to control my glucose or my lipids, or even the improvement in body weight. It's just the sense of self-worth and the psychology of, I just feel better about who I am. This is just having an enormous impact. And then the observations that quite frankly were not anticipated from preclinical work about these addictive disorders somehow being minimized by the pharmacology of these drugs, alcohol, gambling, right, and the like. Maybe it's telling us that there's more overlap with food and its addictive quality to these other elements. So it is broadening how we view complex diseases, and the importance of observational science preclinically and clinically in helping us understand new mechanisms for approaching these diseases. And you know, I'm just delighted to have had a small part in what this has all been about.
I know that was a heavy-handed question to end it off on, but I think you articulated that very well. And it is definitely, you can see now how obesity and like seeing these health benefits kind of extends beyond that to aesthetic reasons and all that, how that all that kind of plays into how we view these therapies and how much they're what they can do. That itself is a conversation of its own that we could talk about forever. So I'll leave it here. Dr. Namarki, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. It's a very, very fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate sharing both the scientific and the historical perspective behind these therapies and where the field's maybe heading next. And to our viewers, thank you so much for tuning into the GLP-1 podcast show. If you enjoyed, remember to like, comment, and subscribe, and I'll see you next time.
Take care. Thank you so much. I appreciate being invited.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.